This is the London FinTech Podcast, bringing you practical insights and approaches, stories and inspiration from the innovators who are building the new world of financial services. Did you know that UK startups raised £17 billion in venture capital in the first half of 2026, or that this is a more than 100% increase on the same period in 25? I'm delighted to be talking with HSBC Innovation Bank about fintech investment today, specifically venture capital-backed investment. HSBC Innovation Bank was the UK subsidiary of the former Silicon Valley Bank, famously purchased for a pound by HSBC in 2023. At the time, they banked thousands of UK innovative tech startups and scale-up firms, and they still do, supporting those businesses with banking, financing and growth support, as well as access to a unique scale-up community. One of the things that the Innovation Bank does regularly is to produce sector research together with Dealroom, and they've just published their Innovation Update report on the first half of 2026. The research shows that the UK has widened its lead as Europe's innovation capital, and we focus in this conversation largely on the UK, perhaps because this is the London FinTech Podcast after all. And the innovation economy itself is now worth £1.7 trillion and is home to 217 unicorn companies. I'm joined by Tom Easterby, who is the Managing Director of FinTech at the bank, and we will be talking about some of the findings from the most recent piece of research and what it means for the innovation economy and growth firms across the sector. We'll also be talking about what you need to do as a founder to get yourself investment ready. Let's go to the conversation. Hi, Tom. It's great to meet you. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Hey, Tony. It's lovely to meet you too.
Yeah, not least because my own consulting business, NextWave, has just completed a venture capital investment barely a month ago. So I've been on the sharp end of this. I've had a very real recent insight into the inner workings of VC and what's required to make yourself investable, what sort of money is out there. And I'd love to really hear the context in the whole of market research and what you're seeing, because you're banking the growth companies of tomorrow.
Oh, absolutely, Tony, and congratulations on your successful raise. I'm sure all the hard work that went into achieving that has been well deserved, and you get a bit of a break now, and then you get to the interesting part of going out and growing your business with those funds that have been raised.
Absolutely. And there was a lot of hard work. There was more hard work during due diligence than we might have expected, but it's knocked all the sort of rough edges off the business, and it's very much underwritten the asset such as it is at the moment. So we're very pleased about that. It was worth it. And the growth phase is ahead of us. We're a services business. We're wrapping our head around this concept of actually spending growth capital, because we're used to spending as little as possible. So that's a bit of a twist. But you're right. It's all very exciting.
Yeah. As a banker, that kind of cost mentality is kind of key to me. So when I hear kind of founders talk about how they're not used to spending money, it kind of raises up all those green flags around someone doing it very diligently with a good dose of ROI attached to it all.
Yeah, we like to think we're going to be putting every spend through the same decision process, regardless of having some funds in the bank that have been tagged for growth, but we're still being cautious. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that. So just to introduce, you say as a banker, I mean, I think you've been in banking for quite some time, but tell me a bit about you and your career to date, if you would.
Yeah, so I head up the fintech team here at the Innovation Bank at HSBC. We're a specialist team, as we'll get into shortly, I imagine, providing banking and funding to fintechs from seed stage right through to IPO and beyond. I've been with the HSBC team, and before that, I was with the Silicon Valley Bank team that got acquired by HSBC since 2020. So kind of deep in that innovation economy piece within those two organizations, where that is just right in the center of our DNA. Across this, I've always been aligned to fintech. I find financial services, I find deeply complex flow of funds, all that kind of juicy stuff, really, really interesting. Before Silicon Valley Bank, I was at Barclays for almost 10 years, really, doing a variety of different roles. And that's kind of where my love of tech really came from. Landed in a generalist team and did a few tech deals, got known as the tech sector expert. And then it all really ballooned from there.
Indeed. And, one of the things that we'll talk about, which I really like about the Innovation Bank, is that you're doing more than just banking your clients. You're bringing some community and some additional services. And I think that's so important that you've sort of got strategic support, if you like, as a founder in growing the business. Before we dive into all of that anyway, just to understand a bit more about any notable hobbies or pursuits that you have when you're not working.
Good question. It's the summer and I love the sun. So I'm usually found outdoors in some variety or other. Sometimes that's quite physical, might be out for a nice long hike or a bike ride. Sometimes it's just lying in the sun. I'm also a fan of a good holiday. So I use my holiday allowance very, very efficiently. And if I'm not planning a holiday, I'm on holiday or I'm thinking about a holiday and traveling somewhere nice and interesting or exotic.
Very good. Yeah. So we've had a very long summer. I think as we're at time of recording, we're going into, I think it's the fifth UK heat wave, which is unprecedented. So if you like the sunshine, like being outdoors, that's great. I mean, it's not obviously great for the garden and a few other things that put a bit of stress on the system. But I have to say, I prefer the summer to the winter. So it's my favourite time of the year as well. Before we jump right into today's episode, a quick thank you to our sponsor, NextWave. NextWave is an award-winning consultancy that is helping many of the world's leading banks, investment managers, and insurers deliver on their growth, efficiency, risk, and control goals and transform their businesses. With a senior team who have come from MD-level positions in major firms like HSBC, Barclays, and UBS, NextWave has both the deep industry expertise and the hands-on capabilities in AI, data, and automation to drive real results. More business outcomes and less PowerPoint from the consulting experience, as their clients like to say. NextWave has moved 2-week manual processes to 5-minute agentic automations, rescued global banking regulatory control programs, and digitized deal platforms, sustainability, and regulatory reporting systems. And they do much of this with hands-on engineering capabilities on leading technologies, which include ServiceNow, Alteryx, Quantexa, and Komunda. So if a modern and specialist alternative to the big brand consulting model sounds appealing, one which covers the full life cycle of strategy specialists and solutions, but with small practitioner teams, rapid delivery, and a better price point, then perhaps you should talk to NextWave. Visit nxwave.com to find out more and get in touch. That's nxwave.com. All right, let's get back to the episode. Okay, so we're going to talk about the investment landscape and banking, the fintech sector. As the head of fintech for Innovation Bank, just to give us context, how many firms is that that's sort of in your portfolio, your bit of the bank? What size are we talking about there?
Yeah, so across our portfolio, we bank about 275 clients. Now, there'll be a real mix from seed stage businesses that have just raised their initial kind of check from a angel round or a well-known seed investor, right through to some of the biggest PLCs in the UK fintech ecosystem. And obviously that tail kind of like gets thinner as we get further up the curve. So we have a large funnel of seed stage businesses, and our ambition and hope is that we can take them through all of those growth stages to get them to the whatever place it is that their ambition wants to get them. If it's an exit via an IPO and to be a PLC, brilliant. Then we've got the kind of right people and the right products to help them get there.
Yeah, and I noted that you're supporting with additional network and services. And I think one of the things you're doing is research, sector research, which helps clearly your portfolio companies navigate the market. So your research, most recent report, which really is the topic for this conversation, has revealed that record AI investment in the last period. So this is the strongest UK startup funding period since 2022. What's been going on? What's behind this?
Yeah, I guess, so just to give you a bit of context about the report, first of all, and Tony, you are right that we do a lot of research, and it's kind of where we are kind of have this enviable place in the market where we can work with partners to be able to look at what our clients are seeing and doing in the market and digest that and then provide those insights back out to market. And so we produce this report with Deal Room on a quarterly basis, and we have done it for many years now. And it combines the proprietary startup database that Deal Room has combined with publicly available information, other sources of information, then also company submitted data that we kind of verify, package up and be able to kind of get a sense of what are the key trends and movements across the UK innovation economy that are interesting both to us as a bank, to our clients that are going through that journey, but also the investors that are kind of helping to fuel some of that activity. And then what's going on really around this H1 dynamic that we're seeing? What's coming out of those numbers? And you are right, it's this record AI investment that we're seeing. I think everyone's almost getting a little bit tired around talking about AI. Every conference you go to, every conversation you have, it's all around AI and how AI is either disrupting or causing new opportunities. And I think the biggest thing we've seen is that AI startups have raised $12.6 billion in H1. Now, this is setting a new record new annual record in just 6 months for AI investment. And it's really showing the kind of the curve of the peak of that hype curve that we're seeing. That meant that funding for H1 is now four times higher what it was in H1 2025. And it's, as you say, it's almost into that same peak level that we saw of the highs of 2022. Some of what's driving that are these mega rounds where we're really seeing investors double down into businesses that have that potential to really move the dial massively, almost like that kind of structural shift within AI. And so what we've seen is you've seen 19 mega rounds alone, which has been driving some of that quantum. And we've seen that'd be right across the sectors as well. So that's kind of enterprise software driven, but also in areas such as healthcare, defense, and some of those kind of more nuanced area where actually AI is really powering the kind of change in the technology in that space.
And what sort of firms are getting funded, Tom? Because AI is everywhere. It's a broad label and it definitely means different things to different people. So I'm sure that not every firm with an AI label is as investable as others. So I'm curious, what does that really mean if you unpack it?
Yeah, and I guess some of those mega rounds that we've seen have been really around that kind of advanced frontier layer to the AI kind of stack that we're seeing. So kind of businesses such as Morphic Labs, Nscale, Wave, even kind of Ineffable, they're all part of where they've got AI that's centric to their business, that's really differentiated and driving that kind of frontier mentality around AI. In the earlier stages, we are seeing lots of the application layer of AI, where we're able to kind of seeing new business types that are using some of those models to really move the dial in on certain areas of development. And so some of that is that application layer that can be put into efficiency gains or new ways of working or new products and systems. But those businesses aren't quite seeing the same level of valuation as we're seeing from some of the mega rounds in the frontier stage of AI development.
So how would you characterize the startup funding environment? I told a couple of people I was going to be having this conversation and who are in the fundraising side of the sector. And they said, isn't it pretty hard to raise money out there at the moment? I said, well, not according to the report. So how would you sort of describe the environment?
Yeah, I think, For all company and all founders wanting to raise money, and Tony, you've just been through this process, right? It's not an easy process and it shouldn't be, right? We should be only seeing the levels of capital we want to go into companies that really have that story and that ability to generate returns for both the investors and also for our economy, right? So it's supposed to be quite an involved process whereby, you know, kind of really road test that the thesis we're investing behind really kind of holds. But what I think is really quite hopeful is that we're not seeing a sex cycle in the market where actually it's really short of capital that's out there to be deployed. I think we're seeing that there is money to be deployed and it's not a situation where LPs are short of capital. There is dry powder available. But what we're actually seeing is VCs being a lot more thoughtful and being a lot more kind of diligent with where they're placing their bets. And all of this is because of this AI seismic shift we're seeing across the innovation economy. And what I mean by that is we want to see the investors, and this, we're doing this ourselves with some of the companies that we're backing with our venture debt products, is we want to see where that money is going to some of those businesses that are able to really drive new, innovative and creating value in the next kind of 10, 15 years. And where that kind of really holds weight is in this new frontier element of AI, where we're really starting to see kind of new processes, new technologies, new layers that we haven't seen before. And it's those areas that are getting vast amounts of money, and it's other parts of the ecosystem that aren't quite seeing the same level of funding that we previously have done before. I think the other point to really make on this, which is really quite important, is that many businesses will describe themselves as AI, but actually they can just be AI powered, AI enabled. And that's fine to be AI powered and AI enabled. And right, that's absolutely kind of part of like the core parts of many parts of the economy now. But it's really being able to articulate what is it within the AI that is making your business so unique and different, or is driving the efficiency or margin within it that's attracting some investment into it.
And is it all about AI? I mean, I think your survey said that some, I think it was 74% of investment had gone into AI, but if I'm right, it was a multi-sector survey. You weren't just surveying AI raises. It was VC investment across sectors, albeit the vast majority is AI. Is that exclusively the case, or what other firms are getting funded?
Yeah, you know, the traditional sectors that require VC funding or look to VC funding are all still being funded. So let's not be kind of like complacent that it's all AI. And indeed, I take a lot of comfort, you know, sitting in a subject specialist team around fintech, that actually there is still funding going into the other spaces that aren't necessarily a pure AI business, but often businesses that are of a traditional fintech or a healthcare or a consumer nature are now becoming much more AI enabled and have that AI labeled to them too. But what we've seen across the market this last H1 is that actually sectors such as healthcare and biosciences in particular continue to be funded very, very well. And so they're still seeing some strong funding. From an actual deal count perspective as well, fintech did see quite strong funding levels. So what we're seeing there is actually a lower actual quantum of funding coming into a sector like fintech, but actually more deals, so smaller check sizes. And for me, that's symptomatic of a business, of a sector that is seeing more of the fundraising come into the earlier stages than in the later stages.
And how do you read that? Is a greater volume of smaller ticket sizes, is that a good thing for the fintech sector?
I think it's a good thing and something to be a little bit wary of. I think it's, for me, it's a sign of the fintech sector maturing. You know, we had a fintech boom in the highs of 2021. And so we've had a lot of businesses that got really heavily funded in that sort of period that have now performed fairly well and gotten to profitability and don't necessarily need the same level of funding again. We've also had the generation of neobanks that have come through their market and have had the kind of bumper late stage raises that have kind of helped to propel those brands really dominate what we've seen from the fintech space. And I think what we're seeing now is some of those mature subsectors within fintech become quite self-sustaining from a financing perspective. Absolutely still massively growing areas of interest and kind of really seeing kind of that part of our sector really perform well. But now we're seeing the VC money go into the new and developing areas, things like agentic commerce, you know, how are AI agents going to help us with our buying decisions? Some of that might be classified as AI. Some of that might be classified as fintech. And we're also seeing kind of things come into new payment rails. You know, we've been talking around stable coins and crypto for a very long time. And I think we're really starting to see some of the infrastructure layer of that get a lot of investment. I'm really starting to see proper use cases that can go into you and I using those tools to improve the way that financial services work for us and for businesses.
So really the next generation of earlier stage growth companies getting funded. And there's two sort of macro themes across the sector, one of which is AI and everything agentic. And the other one, which you just touched on, is some call it sort of the convergence of TradFi and DeFi. And it's the stable coins, the token assets, the infrastructure play on blockchain technologies, and a huge number of firms in both buckets there. So good to see that they're attracting capital. And it feels, from my read of this anyway, that there's sort of a healthy throughput of next phase firms.
Absolutely, right? You've got to look at is kind of the businesses like Elliptic, their kind of Series D that was raised in May of this year. You know, a business that's supporting the digital asset ecosystem with kind of compliance services, raising a large amount of money to really dominate that space that's going to then therefore help large corporates and also smaller businesses with kind of coping with how can these new payment rails be utilized and fed into your everyday business models. And for someone like Elliptic, it's around how can we be really sure and effective with the way that we can trace fraud and transaction monitoring. So being able to take a tool like that and use the new rails like across that we've seen across the digital asset space, that helps larger businesses to be able to really get comfortable with utilizing that within their kind of day-to-day operating. And as you say, that's for me is the true convergence of TradFi and DeFi, when actually you're starting to see both rails working alongside each other.
Yeah. And, you know, you touched on ticket size and deal volumes. I think the research for first half of the year said that this is $1.4 billion of fintech investment across 105 raises, 105 firms. That was still about a quarter of what was raised in enterprise software, interestingly, in the same period. So I'm curious, what's the investor sentiment on enterprise software? Because we've had, you know, the SaaS apocalypse and valuations coming off. And I'm just curious, what is the market, what are the investors thinking currently in terms of SaaS valuations in contrast to what's going on in AI investment?
I think it's still TBD, to be honest. I think we're seeing a lot of the SaaS businesses, that industry shifting into AI and utilizing AI in the way that they can really kind of move the dial on how they develop software in an efficient way. I'm not necessarily sure that we've got to the end point in that cycle yet to be able to really determine what does a newer version of a SaaS business look like in the age of AI, and therefore be able to get a determination of what do margins look like in those businesses, what does the kind of growth trajectory look to those businesses, and therefore kind of determine what valuation metrics should look like for that type of business. But I do think it's really interesting that kind of you've got that convergence between businesses that are classified as AI and some of that application layer that's being developed within that space, and then the more traditional enterprise software pieces that are kind of software creation on a SaaS perspective.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, it's a really good observation that it's that AI or agentic pivot. How do I take advantage of the AI capabilities to remain relevant and drive future growth? That's what the SaaS companies are all grappling with, and as some with great success. So watch that space.
I mean, just to kind of illustrate it, the idea of a SaaS business that could still rely on nearshore or offshored dev talent to be creating code, that ship has kind of sailed. There will always be now a combination of that together with code that's created via an AI agent. And so being able to find the most efficient way to be able to put the two together to be able to create a business that will have the appropriate margins and take advantage of that, they'll be the winners that we'll see across this.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And the other observation that really sort of jumped out from the report, and it's been the case for some time, I think, but London's prominence as a centre of innovation and capital raising. What's the rationale there? Why do you think London is continuing to be the hub for VC investment?
Tony, that's a question we always ask each other a lot within HSBC Innovation Banking. And I guess if you kind of take it one step further back, the UK has always remained the kind of main engine for VC investment across Europe. You know, just in this last half period, the UK attracted more funding than the next three countries put together, Germany, France, Sweden. The growth we've seen in the UK has been 102%, which is quite a phenomenal level of growth in the half year versus some of the years we've seen previously. So the UK has that dominance, and it's some of that dominance that it gets concentrated into London, and it's that self-reinforced cluster effect that we're seeing that kind of keeps London as being the center for VC investment. What we see is deep pools of capital. There's lots of VCs here in London, and there's lots of VCs that have offices here. If you're an American investor, more often than not, your first office in Europe is going to be in London. It's a huge talent pool. We've got a globally diverse city that people want to come and study in. They want to come and work in. And we've got agencies like London and Partners who do a really good job of trying to attract that entrepreneur talent and keeping it here in the UK. And then you get that kind of mature entrepreneurial flywheel.
Indeed.
We see this a lot in fintech, where you get the likes of like more scaled fintechs that are scaled businesses that are part of a mature ecosystem. You get people that have monetized from them, or people that have been an early employee come out the other end and decide they want to create their own business, and they stay in their home market. And I think that's really quite impactful. But what I will say about London is that over the last couple of years, particularly kind of the last couple when we've been doing this survey, we've really seen strong momentum outside of London with markets such as Cambridge, Oxford, Manchester, Edinburgh, Cardiff. Some of those hubs really begin to see the dial move on the level of founder-based businesses that are starting up, but also the level of VC funding going into those places. And I think that's a really promising part of our ecosystem. It can only be helpful to us if we see some of that effect go around the UK and we see a kind of the UK dominance become much more kind of granular than just a city-based dominance.
So continued momentum in London, which I'm delighted to see, you know, given all the macroeconomics and global political chaos and headwinds, who knows how that could have tracked. There have been various views on that over recent years, but momentum in London, but with a regional expansion now starting to take root.
Absolutely. You know, you think about, you know, if you're going to start a business in somewhere like Manchester, Cardiff, Edinburgh, the kind of other UK capitals, you know, you're only about two, three, maybe even 4 hours away on a train from London. So it's very accessible still to be across the whole of the UK market. But at the same time, you're tapping into a secondary pool of talent. And I'm not saying secondary in kind of quality, but secondary in terms of like, there's a competitive market around it. And what we're seeing across some of the university spin-outs, I'm really seeing a kind of lens of commercialization coming out of the technology being researched in institutions like Oxford, Cambridge, and some of the more specialist universities across the UK really means that if you're going to start a business and you've got an idea that's spinning out of university, you don't need to bring that to London anymore. You can be out in the regions and have the same kind of effect of being around a burgeoning VC and a high growth ecosystem. I think that's very, very good. I think London will still be very, very large and continue that kind of momentum that it has. And I don't think it's going to continue to suck all that talent in. I think we're going to see some benefit from founders and founder-led businesses being out in the UK regions a lot more.
Yeah. What sort of firms in the regions? So is that true as much of fintech as it is of life sciences, for example? Or there are certain sorts of firms that are prospering the most currently in the regions?
The data from our deal room report has been really good at kind of shining a spotlight on where we're seeing some of the kind of sector alignment come into the different UK markets. Across the east of England, particularly in Cambridge, the semiconductor industry has become kind of quite concentrated, and there's been lots of sharing of ideas, talent, investment and stuff around that ecosystem. So seeing a lot of investment in that space. The biosciences market has also always been traditionally very strong out of Cambridge. Certain creative industries and software and AI development has come out of Manchester. Within the fintech ecosystem, I'm always very impressed with what I see coming out of Edinburgh from a wealth tech perspective, where there's lots of investment managers that are there already. And more often than not, you're probably going to see somebody that's been working at an investment management firm for 10, 20 years, face the same problem and finally decided, actually, do you know what? I'm going to go out into the market and I'm going to build the tech that's going to fix this problem. We see something similar happening in the fintech ecosystem of Cardiff, where lots of kind of the tech and the talent that's come out of Admiral Insurance has made that part of the ecosystem really quite ingrained, and there's been a real sharing culture of entrepreneurs coming out of big institutions of that, but also then wanting to go and do something a little bit different, but also in that same financial services high growth lens.
It's really interesting. So there's some tangible pockets of innovation in lots of different UK cities. We shouldn't just be thinking London every time we think about the innovation economy.
I'd almost be thinking, if I was an investor coming from outside of the UK into the UK, I would land in London. I would make myself known in London, but I would then get out to the UK regions and see what's going in some of these other hubs. Interestingly, within HSBC Innovation Banking, we have talent that are based in other UK cities. We've put people on the ground to really be able to kind of get into these ecosystems and really help founders that are there with connections, with ecosystem management, etc. And then also leveraging the HSBC network that we have right across the UK. So those combinations are really being helpful in able to help those founders or those VCs that are coming into a new market and wanting to explore what's going on in, say, Oxford or Cambridge, and being able to kind of be a signposter, be a helpful ecosystem connector in some of those markets.
Yeah, I really like that. It's great that the bank is really helping to extend the horizon, because I think a lot of us who are London-based don't tend to look outside the M25 or even outside the square mile. So
I often joke that it's quite easy to stand on Old Street Roundabout and hand out term sheets. But actually, when you get out into the regions, you can probably find different deals for different types of businesses that might drive different value, and you might not have the same level of competition there.
There you go. So if you see Tom standing out on the Old Street Roundabout handing out term sheets,
it's not a flyer for
me. Maybe it's not a good sign. It's not going to be doing that much longer. Perhaps he'll be on the train to Manchester instead. There's a quote in the report that really describes the fundraising market as an hourglass. I think it's a quote from Oxford University Innovation, actually. So it's strong at pre-seed and at late stage, but the growth stage companies that are in the middle are finding it quite hard to raise. Does that resonate with your fintech clients? Which stage of the investment journey really concerns you the most, Tom?
I think it definitely resonates. And I think that quote is a lot more eloquent than the terms I've been using over the last couple of months, where we've been describing the market as bifurcated, which sounds quite technical and a bit more boring than hourglass. But essentially, across the fintech space for the last year or so, we've really been seeing that. The mega deals for the likes of Monzo and Revolut, et cetera, going on at the very top end of the market, really driving that total quantum that we're seeing into fintech. But as we said earlier, really starting to see a lot more seed raises, a lot more money going into that seed and pre-seed into emerging themes like agentic commerce, like the kind of application of digital assets and stablecoin into real world situations where businesses can use it, that infrastructure layer. And so what we're seeing is kind of those two elements of the market really being quite strong. And some of the more, don't want to say traditional, but kind of those markets, those subsectors that we've seen funded traditionally over the last couple of years, finding it not difficult from a lack of funding, but rather VCs are choosing to place their bets into businesses that really want to be thoughtful and deliberate about where they do that. There's still deals being done at Series A, Series B, Series C, Series D. But actually what we're seeing is slightly fewer of them and a slightly more selective mentality. And I actually see that across all the subsectors in fintech. I don't really see any one or two being stronger than others.
Yeah, that's what resonates particularly with what we heard from our investors, that there is it's quite a selective process. The sort of rule of 40 growth rate plus profit, it doesn't always apply, but that's a good lens to look through, and that there needs to be differentiation, quality, a future story, as we saw sort of three quarters of the time. Now that's based on an AI thesis, an AI differentiation, but those are really the factors in play.
One thing I would add to that is I think the days of growth at all costs mentality have subsided somewhat. And so seeing business models where you need to raise vast amounts of capital just to kind of keep on feeding that kind of growth rate. And as I said, the growth curve being as steep as possible at all costs have waned a little bit. And what we're seeing now is actually business models that can get to profitability more sustainably doesn't mean that they're going to stay at profitability, doesn't mean that that's going to be like shooting to EBITDA positive and beyond, but actually being able to demonstrate that to grow a business in a very, very aggressive and interesting way doesn't necessarily always have to have huge checks being written kind of year after year after year. And what that's being helpful for is showing that sustainable growth can be translated into business models that will kind of weather some more of that economic storm that we've seen, or actually weather some more of the kind of peaks and troughs that we might see across VC funding. Not that we're seeing at the moment, but you never know with some of the geopolitics that's going on, what that might do in terms of translating into kind of LPs and what that might mean for dry powder in the future.
Yeah, totally understand that. And because the landscape out there, the future landscape is, uncertainty is the new normal. And so baking in huge growth rate and market share in an environment where the sands are shifting and no one quite knows what the market landscape is going to look like in, 3 years or even 1 year, it's going to push you more towards, resilience, path to profit, something that's got a strong moat around it, and sustainability.
Yeah. And like, there's always going to be room for those business models that require the first mover advantage in kind of global expansion. And so seeing those businesses that, you know, start in one jurisdiction, but then rapidly move on to other geographies as they kind of try and be the dominant player in each of those spaces. But I think we're also seeing a bit more of a preference now for businesses to really scale and prove out one geography before then going into the next geography and launching there, and having that sustainability of knowing you've got a home market to go back to, but also knowing that you've got pain points that you've been through and achieved and accomplished before going and trying to add extra cost base to your market in the objective of trying to win market share in new markets.
And that's quite a good link, Tom, to the second part of the conversation that I was hoping to have, which is really more for the founders out there. So some founder insights. So can you put a bit of color on who's being backed? You know, what's the average startup founder look like? Are they old folks like me, or is it folks who have been, you know, innovating while they were finishing their A-levels and have only just left school? What sort of background and persona is today's founder?
Yeah, I guess today's founder, the model is shifting slightly. And we are seeing kind of in this period where the bets are being placed in a more deliberate fashion, repeat founders or someone that comes with some sort of entrepreneurial experience and has some sort of passion around that always tends to kind of rise to the top of the pack. Within fintech, we regularly see people that have been within an industry for multiple years that have taken that experience and then want to put that into a new venture as being something that kind of VCs can really buy into and take and wants to see that experience being put to use. I think the university spin-out culture is gaining pace every year. And so seeing some of that research-led innovation that is then being kind of put into a commercial environment and taking the scientists, the thought leaders that are being part of that and putting that into a commercial environment continues to be really strong. And what we see from some of the university spin out organizations across the likes of Oxford, Cambridge, Imperial, and some of the other institutions means that some of that is continues to have that great momentum. I also think there is, coming back to my point earlier about UK regions, I think there's also a desire for some entrepreneurs to want to stay in local markets. So if you are someone from a different city, actually being able to stay there and grow your business with the support of an ecosystem around you that can be slightly closer sometimes than coming into London, where it's, dare I say it, at times harder to make connections, although there is often, you know, plenty of network opportunities around our market.
Yeah. So for sort of serial founders, or at least those who've been involved in startups more than once, which is me, that's good. But for those who are super entrepreneurial coming out of schools, right at the start of the career, then there's plenty of runway for them as well. And I'm always staggered by the depth of talent. And we run a social enterprise program every year, which is about giving young folks a career start. And during the year, we're often talking to and occasionally working with youngsters who've got a startup idea, either as part of a work experience or an internship piece. And we've had folks come in who've built agentic prototypes for Next Wave. There's one I'm thinking of just recently who had almost a portfolio career at the age of 20. I'd been doing photography and two startups and studying rocket science at university, and has just dropped out to go on the funded startup program for Y Combinator and been flown out to California. So that was someone that was in our office a couple of weeks ago, talking about you know, the frontier of agentic solutions. So there are some very bright young folks out there with loads of drive and ambition, which is just brilliant to see.
Absolutely. And I don't think you can ever kind of underestimate how much value can be created from someone that has that level of passion and hustle for something that they're interested in. And we started the conversation with the topic of AI. And I guess, you know, lots of generations of younger people are actually going to be much more AI native in their approach to things than some other generations. And I think being able to kind of find interesting opportunities for young entrepreneurs to really demonstrate that they are forward-thinking in the way that they approach AI in all of their parts of their life will then naturally lead into how can they be able to develop business models and a passion project that will kind of balloon into an investable commercial venture.
Yeah, and so let's touch on that. So you're either end of the spectrum as a driven entrepreneur with a great business idea, and you've already created, and I think this is a prerequisite, you've created your business, and maybe some way down the track, what things should you work on as a founder to be investment ready, to be interesting to the VC community?
We always talk about kind of somebody's pitch, right? We're a people business. We've all got these ideas and everyone's got these kind of big opportunities that can kind of result in something that can drive value and growth. But being able to articulate that is really, really important. So being able to work on what is it that you're working to build that can be differentiated, pulling out those factors that make you different from the next person that's coming into the room, and being very eloquent and constructive around how you voice that is really, really important. And that's been unique for the past 10 or 20, 30 years of the VC ecosystem. I also think it's really important now to be able to demonstrate where your business is going from a kind of a future longevity perspective in the lens of AI. So as we're starting to see mass adoption of AI and it coming into not only individuals' lives, but corporate lives, being able to understand how your business model can be working either alongside that, using those tools, empowering with those tools, driving value with those tools is really quite important. So much of the value creation we're seeing has comes out of AI, and being able to demonstrate that you are part of that and having that core to your business is really, really helpful.
So clarity of product market fit and being able to pitch that, super important, and understanding your AI roadmap and AI proposition, or at least your proposition in an AI world, which may or may not be an AI proposition itself. But I think those two things coming out clearly.
Yeah, and one is a consistent theme that we've had across the market for a long time. The other is a new theme. It's the piece that kind of is part of this seismic shift we're seeing across our market.
Yeah. And are there different types of VCs out there, Tom, for different types of scale-ups?
Absolutely, yes. And we work with all sorts of kind of different types of capital when we're working with our startups. At the earlier stage, sometimes as simple as an angel network or an angel might be the kind of source of initial capital that'll be useful to an entrepreneur, in that you're getting that kind of close one-on-one support and advice from often someone that's done the journey within your space and sector. Within the kind of broader world of VC investment, the traditional VCs that operate in the LPGP structure, that's very, very common and very, very prolific. What we've seen increasingly is around the corporates coming into the market. And so corporate CVCs and being able to see corporate money act in a VC manner being another additional source of capital that kind of can be raised. And that's not even kind of getting into some of the areas where we can combine some of that capital alongside government money as well in the form of either regional or national pots of government money. But what that does in these different parts is being able to kind of allocate the right type of capital to the right type of use. In fintech, we often have this dynamic between traditional VCs and CVCs. If you're going to sell into banks and you want to have access to a bank that can help you really understand how your product fits into the machine of a large bank, sometimes partnering with a CVC as some of your earlier stage funding can be really helpful to that. You often come with a strategic initiative that will be part of the bank's growth agenda. And so being able to plug into that and be part of that would really help you drive how your product will fit into an institution that you're looking to sell to. And that's not unique to fintech. You see this across some of the other specialist sectors like climate or indeed healthcare.
CVC, so just for my education, just a minute or two, just can you unpack that for a second as to how, what those really are and how they're put together?
Corporate venture capital. And so these can be in a variety of forms. More often than not, it could be a large corporate saying, we're going to start a team. We're going to put a pot of dedicated funds that's ring-fenced to go and invest in businesses that we think can either be a dial mover for our revenue or fix some problems within our machine, so efficiency gains. more often than not, it can be a team within a bank or another large institution that has the ability to kind of go and invest into businesses that you ordinarily might just procure with or kind of have a commercial contract with. And so by aligning those interests and becoming a shareholder with them helps to kind of really put the driving, the corporates as part of the driving seat of some of the technology innovation that they want to plug in and change their business. What I think is really interesting, it can come from an angle of both revenue. So this is new products, new services that we would like to put into our roster, but also really interesting ways to drive efficiencies, to drive new product, to drive new ways that the kind of customers can interact with that.
Yeah, and we have seen this a lot across the fintech sector. So the likes of Standard Chartered Ventures or Citi Ventures and all the big banks have done it and we're buying into up and coming innovation businesses that have, in many cases, have an alignment or become a supplier of the bank, right? So everyone wins in that model.
Us here at HSBC, you know, within the Innovation Bank, we talk to fintech founders, fintech businesses every day. My team are out kind of talking to businesses from seed stage right through. And so we're also having conversations within HSBC to talk to the HSBC Ventures team and the HSBC technology teams around what is it that you're looking for at the moment? What are the problem statements that you're trying to work with? And so being that helpful connector between those that we're seeing out in the market and those that we're seeing behind the scenes within the brand and trying to find ways to put the best technologies in front of the best technologists within HSBC is really quite helpful. And our ventures team do a brilliant job of kind of investing into them.
And we'll come to that in just a moment because I think that's part of your sort of secret sauce. But for a growth firm, how important is it who you bank with? And I think you'll quite like this story for us because and I won't say which one of the neobanks we've been banking with since we started. But when we started looking for capital raising in VC in the market at the end of last year, one of my finance advisors very quickly said, oh, you're going to need a proper bank. You should go and bank with HSBC. So that seemed to be a thing that just like you need grown-up lawyers and grown-up advisors and grown-up board structures, you also need choice of bank can be quite important. What's your view?
So without making this too much of a plug for HSBC Innovation Bank,
yes.
I often think around the journey that our founders go on as being, it's so specialist and so unique in its way versus the rest of the economy, that it's important to be able to wrap yourself with the types of advisors, the type of service providers that understand and know your sector and market. Now that can be understanding the journey you're about to go on through the funding growth journey, or it could be your sector. Often businesses of the size and scale that we work with within the Innovation Bank, if they were to work with more traditional banks outside of an innovation wrapper, they'd be getting service through a call center, or they wouldn't have named relationship point of contacts. So they wouldn't have that benefit of being able to speak to someone who understands their sector, understands some of the challenges they're going through, and being able to, A, turn that into appropriate banking services to help with that journey, but B, be also be able to help on some of the kind of tertiary things that we support our clients with, whether that be ecosystem connectivity or being able to talk to them around the challenges that they're facing and the experiences we've seen from other founders within our portfolios, and being able to take some of that knowledge we see across our specialist space and being able to kind of convert that into really helpful nuggets of support, advice and guidance. And so where you're kind of getting that from a very specialist team, you wouldn't necessarily have that for the type and size of business you are if you're in a more traditional environment. I also would add into that that within the world of the innovation banking, we've developed lots of specialist banking products and services. So what we do around lending to businesses that are VC backed in the form of venture debt and various forms of working capital requires us to really know and understand the journey that some of the businesses are going on to be able to spot the credit risks that mean we get comfortable with lending into these sorts of businesses. And many more traditional banks wouldn't have that same sort of experience to be able to do those sorts of facilities to the types of businesses that we work with.
Yeah, and we've recently taken a look at this post-investment, and I have to say, you do have the Innovation Bank, and this is the plug bit, it does have a wide range of sort of very tailored, bespoke products and services for fintech growth firms. And if you couple that with what I think you described as the sort of specialist advisory research, the connection and network capability, I've learned in our journey that it's so important to have advisors and specialists around you, because you can very quickly forget that you don't know the answer to everything, or worse, there's sort of miss an opportunity to get some expert insight that's going to completely remove an obstacle and move you forward. Our example was the capital raising. I didn't know it was possible actually for Next Wave at the time, but I asked a couple of people and suddenly a few doors opened, and the path that we've taken is not unique. It's just one that I didn't know about at the time.
Yep. And we talked about AI at the start of the call, and that's been the theme across this session. But at the end of the day, we work well with people. Everybody works well with people, right? And we're many businesses across the kind of broader economy. We're all being disrupted by AI. We're all being disrupted about new brands of innovation. But at the end of the day, being able to work with people is really quite important. And so when you bank with someone like a neobank, and the look and feel is fantastic, speed of execution on some of the bits is great, but when you have a problem and you need to speak to someone, that's when you get a little bit more unstuck. And founder's time is incredibly rare. You know, you're probably rushed off your feet day in, day out, working 7 days a week. So being able to have that ability to know that you can pick up the phone and speak to an individual who knows you, knows your business, knows your sector, is invaluable.
I couldn't agree more. And without going into specifics, we had a sort of tragic comedy moment when we closed our investment, where a same day payment, clues in the title, actually took 5 days. To go from one bank to another, and it was literally the investment check, and so you can imagine how much stress that caused. And we were talking to a chatbot. So anyway, that's it. We could take that conversation offline. Tom, what do you see as the outlook for the UK's innovation economy at this point?
I still think the UK's innovation economy is very strong. I think we've got the strong fundamentals. We talked about our UK dominance. We talked about London dominance. And I think that's got the kind of flywheel effect to continue. I think we need to have a period of political stability to give people the confidence to want to go out and start a new venture. I think we need to continue to see VCs funding in a variety of different ways that we discussed. And I think there's plenty of capital there to be deployed in the right way. So I'm feeling very, very, very positive. I'd like us to see the innovation economy being the driving force for broader, wider economic growth across the UK economy.
Love that. And what would be your top takeaways for the audience? Perhaps what one for the investors out there and one for the current or aspirational entrepreneurs out there?
Key takeaways. That's a good question. Right. So for the VCs out there, if you're not already, explore what the UK regions are up to. If you need some guidance and support, HSBC Innovation Banking have colleagues in different markets that can be the hand holder into those new spaces. For the founders out there, I think understand how your proposition fits into AI. Understand what your go-to-market, your market looks like in an AI lens, and really be able to articulate why your use of AI, why you in the age of AI is going to be a dominant player across whatever space it is that you're looking to add value to.
Yeah, thank you. Great insights. And we're going to run out of time in a moment. But what's coming next from HSBC Innovation Bank? You are the innovation bank, so I assume you are innovating at all times. And there must be a few things just over the horizon.
Yeah, absolutely. We continue with our kind of regional focus, but we also continue with our international focus. So we're part of the HSBC network across the globe, and we're rapidly rolling out the innovation banking brand to new markets across the world. We've already got guys on the ground in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, India, Israel, all across Europe, all across North America, and that's going to continue more. So if there's an innovation hub somewhere that you're expanding into and you want some support into that market, I'm sure we can find the right innovation economy people from HSBC to partner with you there. And we also continue to put some of the interesting and bespoke HSBC product that's being developed into the innovation bank. So what I mean by that is we're being able to provide proper large banking services to businesses as they scale quite earlier in their journey than they might get from more traditional banks. And that's quite exciting and all part of the journey of what makes HSBC Innovation Banking continue to evolve in itself.
Yeah, and I think that's the strength of the mothership and clearly huge international presence and balance sheet, but also all the other innovation in products and services that are going on across the global bank, and being able to pull the best bits of that at the right time into what you offer through the innovation bank.
Absolutely.
So, okay, well, we have run out of time, but so that may well have piqued the interest of current or future entrepreneurs and founders out there. So if anyone wants to get in touch with your team, find out more about, you know, what it takes to start up in the regions, or how do I get involved with support for an international office or whatever it may be, what's the best way, Tom?
Yeah, you can find lots of interesting detail on our website, hsbcinnovationbanking.com. We talked around the deal room report at the start of this call, and there's lots of really great similar content on our website there to help founders. There's also ways to get in touch with the various teams across all the different sectors we work. But if you want to get in touch with me personally, I'm on LinkedIn, Tom Easterby. You'd be fine with me. There's only one of me.
We'll link the report in the show notes. And yeah, I'd encourage anyone out there who wants to get a deeper insight into the sector or potentially get some support in their growth journey to get in touch. Super set of insights, Tom. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
No, thanks for having me, Tony. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.